SNL Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at Blackford High School in San Jose, California on November 29th, 1996. Tonight's 15-minute speaker is Robert Q. of San Jose. Tonight's one-hour speaker is Linda R. of San Jose. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
My name is Robert. I'm an alcoholic. I got told about 15 minutes ago that I was going to be the 15-minute speaker, so no preparation, but that's probably good. Doesn't give me any time to think about it, and I'll come up here and go blank, and that's good, because then it'll be God talking. I came to these rooms probably actually the first time was in Los Angeles when I got a DUI. And I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I knew something was wrong, but I didn't think it was my drinking. I think it was everything else. It was kind of funny. I used to go into those meetings, and I'd sit there, and I'd listen to people talk, and I go, oh, man, all these people, they belong here. They're all fucking crazy. And but then I'd go outside, and I'd smoke a joint while they were going out and laugh at them, going, oh, yeah, man, you guys got a problem, man. Look at all you crazy fucks. And there I am. You know, sitting up there getting loaded. It didn't take but about probably 3 or 4 more years of hard running to end up back in these rooms. I started drinking alcohol when I was 11 years old. The first time I drank 3 quarts of Budweiser. Then I went to my buddy's house. His parents were at the officers' club partying themselves, and we decided to find out what it would like, you know, just mix every alcohol in the bar together. And it was a big glass, and I remember drinking about half of it, and that's about all I remember. But the next morning when I woke up, my buddy's mom was, like, sitting next to me with a big smile on her face, and I didn't have a smile on mine because I was hung pretty good. And she had a beer in her hand, and she says, here, you know, you want, this is the only thing that's going to cure that headache, you know. I took one whiff of that and was in the bathroom praying to the porcelain god again. And swore I'd never do it again. You know, but 2 weeks later, I was back down in Maryland drinking some more. And the funny part is when my drinking career first started, I would drink till I puked, and I earned the nickname Puke, you know, because it was like... every time I drink, I'd puke, you know, but then I'd drink again, you know, and I drink till I blacked out. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had other isms also, you know, and they came right along with it. You know, after 2 weeks of my first time really getting drunk, I was starting to smoke pot, or at least trying. And it was funny because the first time I smoked pot, it didn't do anything for me. But then the next time I went over to another guy's house and we were smoking out of a big 4-foot bong. Well, what I didn't know was on the bottom of this big bowl was some PCP. And the funny part was I liked it. I don't think I've really found a drug I haven't liked or an alcohol I haven't particularly liked or disliked, I should say. So that continued for many years. I was selling PCP and whatever else in school and making my way through life. And my parents were split up, so I had a lot of time on my own. My mom was too busy out partying, drinking, doing her thing, and I was at home at 11, 12, 13, raising myself basically and trying to stay alive in the streets of Southeast Washington, D.C. When I was going to school back there, I was a minority myself. It was like 92% colored, so I was like very much a minority. And this was back during the mid-70s, during all the racial tension back east. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of that part, too. which the alcohol kind of helped, and the drugs definitely helped, you know, to get through that type, through that phase of my life. Got through that without being dead, which is a good thing. Then I moved to Reno, Nevada, probably when I was about 14, I guess, just turned 15, and decided I was going to become a jock, and that was funny. So I started running. You know, actually what happened was my cousin challenged me one day. He looked at me and says, I don't think you could run 15 minutes, you know, because I was a smoker, and I smoked pot, and I smoked cigarettes, and I drank beer, and I drank other things and did other things, and he says, well, I don't think you could run a half an hour. I says, okay, I'll run a half an hour, and I'll whip your ass. So we ran, and I did. And so then I started running 5 miles in the morning, five at night, and I still smoked a couple cigarettes, and I'd have a beer every now and then, but I swore I wasn't going to drink pot or smoke pot anymore or do any more drugs. That lasted through about my freshman year in high school, and the last two or three days I started smoking again. And it pretty much went downhill from there. My mother got in a lot of financial problems. My parents were split up at the time. And I took on a job, a summer job at the MGM Grand in Reno. And I went through the ranks as a busboy there pretty quickly and ended up dropping out of school and was a waiter in the coffee shop there. And at that time, I was probably making $1,000 a week in tips and wages. And for a 16-year-old kid, that's just too damn much money. You know, I'd make $100, $120 a night, and I'd be broke by the time I'd go back to work the next day. And the reason why, of course, you know, was the drugs and the alcohol. So I continued that for probably another few years, and I decided that I was going to get my GED and go back to college, and I did that. Never finished that. You know, I really haven't finished anything until I got into these rooms. Everything's always been half measured. I mean, I used to smoke pot before I'd go to my classes in college, you know, and I figured, well, you know, I took psychology. And they said in the book there, you know, that if you studied loaded, you know, you got to take the test loaded. So I figured, oh, that's cool. You know, I'll just stay loaded all the time. And because then I can recall what I'm supposed to be learning. And it actually worked, you know, I guess, because I carried a 2.25 grade average working full-time 50 hours a week. And I was on my own at that time also. I got on my own when I was about 16. My mother couldn't take it anymore. I came home from school, or actually from work one day, and everything was gone except my stuff. You know, she just decided, well, I think, which I don't really blame her because I was pretty much of a handful. Then I started catching DUIs. I caught one in San Diego, and I caught two here in San Jose. I went through the first conviction program twice, and even through the second time, I swore, oh, I'm never going to be back in these programs again. You know, I just fuck this AA shit. They're all crazy. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be back in these alcohol awareness programs, whatever the hell they call them. And I figured none of them knew what the hell they were talking about. And but the funny part was, is Saturday Night Live used to be over at the El Paseo, and there's a member here named Walt, and he was talking one day. And it was one of the probably few things that I heard when I was in these rooms that kind of stuck with me, and it really pissed me off when it did stick with me, because he was sharing from the podium one day, and he says, you know, he says, I don't care if anything that you might hear, he says, but, you know, there's going to be that little seed that gets planted in your head, and one of these days you're going to be sitting in a bar and you're going to be getting drunk. And he goes, and this is for these people that are on the court cards, you know, that you don't think you have a problem. He says, but you're going to be sitting in a bar one day, and he says, you're going to think about what I said, and he says, all of a sudden guilt's going to come across, you know, and you're going to feel guilty as hell, and I'm going to ruin your drinking. And I'll be a son of a bitch if I wasn't sitting in a bar one time, and I was nice, halfway hammered, and I thought about that, and I was like, oh, you fucker, man. I could never drink right again. You know. And I told him that, too, when I came back into the rooms on my own accord. And he just smiled and said, yeah, you know, I've had a few people tell me that, you know. And so I finally made it back in these rooms around February of 1993. And When I got back here, I was just finished. I mean, I had gotten another DUI. They had taken my vehicle. I had half of my clothes in it and half of my work tools. And they weren't going to give me back my truck. I had altered tags, all kinds of shit. When the cop pulled me, when they pulled me over, they said that I tried to avoid a sobriety checkpoint, which they were half-assed, right? But I saw a sign. I thought it was a construction zone. You know, I was basically too ripped to really read from that point. You know, I didn't have any glasses because hell, who would want to buy glasses? You know, that would mean that I wouldn't be able to get my dope or my drink, you know. So I was like, shit, the hell with glasses, I can see very well, I can see fairly well without them. I know better now, but so I made the right hand turn, and all of a sudden there come the bubblegum lights, and I got the people behind me, and then I turned to the old shit god again. Oh shit god, I swear if I can get through this one, I'm not going to do this again. Sure. So I ended up in jail one more time. And it was funny because I was sitting in jail and I was telling the cops, he looks at me, you know, they were talking, they were trying to tell me to walk the line and all this other horse shit. And I looked at the guy and I go, hey, you know what, man, it doesn't matter what you tell me to do. You can tell me to walk the line, all this other bullshit. I'm gonna fail it, so let's just go. And I says, I'm not going to play your games, you know, I don't want to, let's just go blow because I know I'm going to be over anyway. So we did, and I was over, so they kept me. And they ended up keeping my vehicles and everything else, and the person that I was working with at the time, his company was basically going under. And so I was staying with him and his wife, and he just told me at that point, you know, hey, you're getting too much, man. We can't keep you around here anymore. So I said, oh, cool. You know, fuck you too. You know, because he basically burned me for money again. And I split. So there I am. I don't have a house. I don't have a job. I don't have no place to stay. I had maybe $50 in my pocket. And I went to a friend of mine, which was somewhat of a friend at the time, which really kind of surprises me that we are friends and we're still roommates. Because when he was in the joint, I got his old lady pregnant. And he was a big boy when he got out, you know, so. And we're best friends now, but, you know, that's kind of, it's God working in his funny ways, I guess. Yeah, that's a real hard one, believe me. When he got out of the joint, too, he was big. I mean, you know, he's my height, but he weighed about 250 when he got out, and I was like, oh, shit. You know, I was looking for a gun, and I didn't have it. A friend of mine just calmly brought him back down to earth and reminded him that he's a dog too. So, that all came out in the fourth step too, but you know, and in the tenth, but you know, I don't practice those behaviors anymore, thank God. But, so I ended up crashing on his couch and I started working with the guy that I'm partners in business with now, and that was about 5 years ago. And he put up with me for about a year, but he told me when I started working for him, he says, I told you when you were working with my brother that if I ever got something going on myself that you could, that I'd have you work for me in a heartbeat. He says, because I know that you're qualified and you're a good worker. And I said, cool. So, and he's been in the program probably 11 or 12 years. I think he just turned 11 this last year. And I was looking at him and seeing all the nice things he had and saw that he was pretty level-headed. And you know, he was going someplace and he didn't know dick about the business that we were in, but he was still doing it. So I saw a slight attraction there, and plus I was pretty tired. You know, I'd been running about 19 or 20 years at that point. And so I was, one day I was driving home from a job, and we had a 57 flatbed at the time. That was our first flatbed. And the lights didn't work too well on this thing. You know, they would turn on when they wanted to. I guess it had a mind of its own or something. And this particular day, the damn lights wouldn't go on. And I had just been at a gas station, and I was thirsty. I'd just gotten off work. It was about 6 o'clock at night. And I figured, well, hell, I'm going to stop and get something to drink. Well, I'd normally get a beer. And I thought about it, and I go, well, I had about a buck or two in my pocket. And I said, no, I don't want a beer. I'll just buy a soda. So I bought the soda, and I pulled out, and I tried to turn on the lights on, and wouldn't work, and there was this funny-looking car in front of me but didn't have no lights on top of it. It sure looked like a cop to me. And I'm trying to get these lights to work. I'm, like, panicked at this point because I've got a suspended license at the time for my other DUI. Well, the damn lights wouldn't come on, but so this car in front of me pulls over, and I'm going, great, you know, and then they finally turn on after he pulls over. And I look in my rearview mirror, and there he is up behind me again, and the lights go on. And I'm going, all I can say to myself was, well, at least I'm not drinking this time, you know. So the cop pulls me over, and I tell him the truth. I go, hey, look, I'm on a driving on a suspended, blah, 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 blah. I went through the whole spiel with him, and he goes, I tell you what. He says, if no warrants come up, he says, I'll go ahead and let you go. He says, I'm not going to let you drive. He says, I'll take you to the phone. You can call someone. So I said, fine. So he's writing me up a ticket, and next thing I hear coming over the radio is your suspect, Qualch Robert William, $20,000 no walkover warrant, violation of probation. I go, oh, great. Okay, well, fine, let's go. So he says, well, you can pull your truck over there, and then we'll go. So he says, but don't run. And I says, yeah, you got my name and everything, and I'm going to run and make this situation worse. I don't think so. So we went to jail, and this is the time when my moment of clarity came. I was laying in Elmwood, just got back from court, telling the guy, hey, look, I've got a job, this, that, and the other thing. I'm going to pay this fine. He says, we got your ass here. You're going to serve it $70 a day. So I'm going, great. Well, it turns out that I'm laying in bed, and I'm going, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, Jesus, Robert, the only time that you're ever in jail is either if you're drunk or if you're on drugs or both. Never been related to anything else. Never went to violent crimes or anything else. It was always drug and alcohol related. And the light went on, and I started remembering some of the things that I had heard in these rooms. So I decided when I left there that I had a 12-pack of beer at home, and I, you know, being the good alcoholic that I am, I couldn't waste that, so I had to go home and drink that first. So I went home and I drank that 12-pack of beer. And that was February 5th of 93, and I haven't had to take a drink, fill or fix since then. And life and sobriety, God, I've never had it so good, you know. I hear Vic say that every time he comes up here and says, I love you, we love you, and there's nothing you can do about it, you know, and he had a marvelous day today. And, you know, my days are getting better and better, and there are bad ones, there are good ones, you know. The last couple weeks here, everything's been going. I mean, God's been providing the promises that he promises to provide. I've had some really interesting things happen. I'm not going to go into details on those, but they've basically set me up for my life. And financially wise, I don't have to worry about things. And in this program, it's like they say, finance and romance are the two biggest offenders. So at least I don't have to worry about the one. I just have to worry about the romance part. And in my life, that's a difficult one. So I just particularly care to stay away from that. My suggestion to any of the newcomers is to stay in the solution. And the solution is in the book. Find yourself a good sponsor that knows the steps, knows the book, and let them take you through it. And just keep an open mind. Because without open-mindedness, willingness, and honesty, you'll be back out there. Just that quickly. I've seen a lot of people come in and out of these rooms. I'm glad to see Marty back. There's a lot of people that were here when I got here that are in this room now. And I was pretty twisted when I got here. I had hair down to here, and I was had a bad attitude. I hated everyone and everything. But I'm not that anymore. You know, I have a loving God in my life. You know, when I did the third step, my sponsor at that time told me to write down all my wills, my wants, and my haves on a piece of paper. Well, my haves took up about a half paper at that time. My wants filled up probably 10 pages. And my needs filled up probably 5 pages. And after I finished it, you know, I was all proud. I came back to him, hey, man, look, I got this shit, you know. And he looks at me and he smiles and he goes, well, He says, after we do this prayer, he says, as a matter of fact, he says, we'll do it now. I lit the pages on fire and said, you're not going to need this. You're not going to need these lists anymore. You don't need to worry about any of this because everything that you wrote down on there, it's not up to you anymore. It's all up to God. Because all your wills, all your wants, and your needs will all be met as long as you follow the spiritual principles of this program. And I have to say that he's definitely right about that. I'm not perfect. You know, I don't think anybody in this room is. I don't think there's anybody in this world that is. All I can do is just try to be the best person that I can be and don't step on people's toes. And when I do, admit it promptly. And I didn't think I could talk for 15 minutes, but it looks like I did. The only thing I'll end with is, you know, there's a part in the book here, and it's at the back of the book, which is like a good alcoholic, I always go to the back. And it's the spiritual experiences, and there's one part in here that one sentence, now if I can find it. And it's the last paragraph, and it says, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Basically what that's telling you is if you close your mind and you don't learn this book, you won't stay here. Thanks. Linda Ra.
My name's Linda and I'm Kevin's higher power. I'm an alcoholic. He'll tell you himself. He'll do that. My name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic, and I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You know, I just think about that when it was like 9 years ago, and I came in, and I didn't even know what recovering from a seemingly hopeless state. I knew I was hopeless, and it certainly seemed that way at the time, and I don't know. It seems like, you know, when I had to admit that I was an alcoholic, it was like, man, people were telling me I was an alcoholic. I don't know. I said, you know, I really don't know whether I'm an alcoholic. They're going, man, you're alcoholic. I don't know. Do they tell normal drinkers they're alcoholic? I don't know. I don't think so. It's like they're saying, Linda, you're an alcoholic. I'm going, I don't know. Maybe I am. I didn't care. I mean, did you care and show you were ready to stop? No. So time went on. I drank always. I always enjoyed a good drink. When I was a kid, I enjoyed good drink. My grandpa was a wino, and we came out from Kansas, and he always had those bottles of wine in his pocket. You know, you could just go in, and it was like Boone's Farm time. I mean, he was cheap wino, the kind you'd follow to the grocery store and watch him dig around for the wine in the garbage bin and be like, ooh, Grandpa's got some today, you know, me and my two sisters. And then we'd get home, we'd go and rip his bottle off, you know, and we'd stand on the lawn and we'd be tossing the bottle in a triangle, you know, keep away from Grandpa, got the bottle. Give me that thing. I'd be like, I don't know, he was a trip. He was thirsty, that's what he was, he was thirsty. But I didn't know at the time that the man needed to have a drink. You know, I didn't know what it was he needed to have that drink. It wasn't like keep away to Grandpa. Grandpa needed to have that drink. You know, that's just where I come from, and that's where I learned how to drink, you know. And people during that time, they didn't really think about alcoholism. It wasn't like, gee, you know, we have drug awareness week. You know, they didn't have that stuff. And so they let you drink, you know, they let you drink during the holidays. That was good. You got to drink out front, you know. It's like, hey, get them long, tall bottles of wine that have the wicker on and be like, yeah, you know, trying to get down there. my parents would have parties, and they would feel so bad that you were stuck in the room. And, you know, they'd come, and they'd knock on the door, and they'd be like, gosh, you guys are stuck in the room. Here, we brought you this little drink. And I'd be all like, oh, goody, you know, and I'd go and stick it in my windowsill. Never mind, I had, like, the whole windowsill lined, so I had it all set up for the night, you know. They didn't know I had tons of drinks in there. But they'd say, you know, don't get high around Linda. She's weird. She'll freak you out. Don't take acid around her. Whoa. You know, they would say those things. They said, man, she is too weird. Don't trip around her. And I would just start out. I kind of started out on alcohol. I drank. I always drank. And I had this foster sister, you know, and it was kind of like, that's just where we came from. And everybody sniffed glue and gas and things. It was like Pam, I don't know, Pertussin in the bag in the closet. If you didn't have a drink, get some Pam. I don't know, you could still be high. Go in the closet. So I'd be in the room and it'd be all smelling like Pertussin. That's that big stuff. You know, my mom would be all, kids, what are you doing in here? Oh, nothing, Mom. You know, I'm not doing anything. So my foster sister, she was bad. She was just really bad. And she put some mescaline in my dinner. And I took that. I ate that dinner. It was my favorite meal. It was chicken chow mein. I ate it all. I ate everything on the plate. And she said, Linda, I put some mescaline in there. I said, no, you didn't. And I started coming on to it. And it was like, whoa, you really did. Can I have the other half? You know, that's the kind of people we are. More. Can I have some more, please? So as I was just growing up, that's what we did. We just drank and everybody drank. I didn't even know what I was doing drinking. I was a kid. You know, we were the kind of kids down at the grocery store, and we would go with a shopping cart, and we would fill it up with Twinkies and cigarettes, you know, and anything else we could. And we would load up the shopping cart, and we would just go out the door with our loaded shopping cart and go down the creek and distribute the goods, and you could smoke every kind of smoke there was to smoke. You know, you try every brand. And that's what kind of kid I was. And there we were on mescaline. That's when rocket fuel was big. And here I am tripping on acid a couple times a week. And all the time I'm thinking, I'm a kid. When I think about this, I am a little girl. I'm in elementary school when I'm loaded, and I can remember just blacking out and throwing up and all that stuff. By the time I was in junior high school, I was doing everything. I went through high school like that. I was the kid behind the backstop drinking the orange juice and vodka, you know, and I thought that was cool. Have the joint on the way, get the orange juice, get the vodka, go to class. I mean, isn't that normal? Sounds normal. It's normal to me. I thought that's how it was. My dad had a tapper. I don't know if you know about tappers, but they're so good because it was in a refrigerator and you cannot see through them. So you could just say, no, I didn't do it. They never know how much beer is in that keg. And you could just drink. And I would leave school 11 o'clock and I'd go drink. So that's basically, I mean, who hasn't drank? I drank. All those things happened. I had miserable relationships. I had violence. I came from serious domestic violence. I got married. I drove truck all across the United States of America. That was great. You know, I drank all over every highway in this United States. I swear I have. And I drank in Florida, went out to the Florida Keys. That was very cool to drink out there. You could see, actually see the bottom of the ocean out there. Anyways, but I always thought my husband was an alcoholic. I was sure he was an alcoholic, right? Like the cartoon character that melts, you know, just right out of the seat, just goes right on the ground. Like, dang, look at him. You know, everybody just, we thought that was normal. We didn't even stop eating. We just kind of picked him up, threw him on the sofa, and went on with our Thanksgiving meal. It was like that. That was normal. We just thought people drank like that. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink like I drank. I didn't know anybody who didn't use like I used. That was totally normal to me. Then when I got married and, you know, I had my daughter and stuff, I was thinking, well, I was really trying to be good. You know, I don't know if you ever tried to just, like, not drink, but it just sucks. That's the bottom line. When you're just trying not to, or you're trying to have one, you know, and you want more, and that phenomenon of cravings on you, we didn't call it that at the time. It was like, oh, I'm just trying to be good. But, you know, the thing is that you never know after you take that first drink which nights you're going to be able to not to stop and which nights you're not. I never knew what day would happen. So controlled drinking just never worked for me. You know, I would just be totally wasted, and I would think I was just going to have one. I meant to just have one. But, you know, I just wasn't good at having one. But I don't know. Maybe some of you have done that. So after I got married and all that stuff, then I got divorced. That's what happened. I got divorced, and I remember reading AA literature, and I thought, you know what? I thought that I read that I might have to stop drinking along with the alcoholic, and I said, no, I think I just need to get a divorce, and he needs to stop drinking. I mean, that's what I really thought. I consciously thought that thought. You know, I think he needs to stop, and I just need to get divorced. And that's how I rationalized everything, and I went on to work for this sheet metal company, and everybody had lines in their drawers, and everybody drank. I mean, we drank. The whole company was just totally perfect for an alcoholic addict like myself, you know. It was like, this was the place to work. Everybody had dope. Everybody had a drink, and you could call in because you partied with the boss the night before and say, man, I am just hungover. I could go in my office and lock the door and pass out right on my rug for a little while, just a little while in the morning, and I was okay. It was normal. You know, everybody around me drank and used like I did, and I didn't know that there was any other way to do anything. I didn't know that I even wanted to do anything different until it got really bad. Then I got remarried into a really violent relationship. It was okay to start with, but there's a lot of domestic violence, you know, that goes with drugs and alcoholism. And I was one of those. It was bad, you know, starting with the push, the shove, and then the strangling. You know, it's like you can't get to the phone because you're being strangled with it. It's like it doesn't make for a good phone call that way, you know. And so I never got to the phone. All I got was beat up. And my daughter was there. Most between, she was 3 and 5, I guess, between those ages, maybe 2 and 5, being locked in the car down in the garage, and I can't get to her because I'm too busy being loaded and beat up upstairs. You know, those are the kind of things I had, but I couldn't call the police because I'm high. And if I call the police and I'm high and I'm all beat up and I'm loaded, they're going to take my daughter. You know, so it was just like, you know, it was insanity to live like that. And I remember laying on the bed one night and I crossed over that invisible line. It was just like I knew that I was physically changing as I laid there going, I am crossing something. I knew something was happening to me, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't have a name for it. You know, as becoming an addict, I already was an addict, but it was kind of like you just know when you crossed over, and there's no point at that time of return. So as it got bad, you know, I knew if I didn't stop drinking and using as it came down to it, I tried everything I could try. I was in a horribly abusive relationship. I got beat up really often, and probably for the last year, I got hit on almost every day. I was getting hit and just, you know, using crank and just ready to have a nervous breakdown behind all this insanity. I don't know, people, they were tired. I burned all the bridges. We don't want to help her anymore. She's sick, you know. My family's going, we don't understand this. I mean, alcoholism and drug addiction is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I don't know why. I don't know when I talk to women today and they have everything on the line. Still baffles me, even knowing that I was one of them. And even now having the solution, it's even sometimes harder for me to understand. Like, here, I have a solution for you. I have a way for you to stop drinking and using one day at a time. And your life can change, you know, and it just baffles me. Like, we put everything on the line so that we could get loaded, you know, our families, our children, our marriages. It's just insanity. To me, that is, like, insane. And you know, it all starts with that first drink. And the only place that talks about insanity in the big book is the insanity that precedes that first drink. That we think, oh, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to have just one. I never knew when I could have just one. This time I'm not going to get beat up. This time I'm not going to black out. This time I'm not going to throw up. I can move. I cannot move. I mean, this is the way we think. I'll eat before I drink. No, I got sick the last time I ate before I drink. So this time I'm not going to eat before I drink. And I'm only going to drink a certain kind. You know, we switch from the wine to the beer to the vodka to the whiskey. I mean, I liked whiskey. I don't know. Whiskey on rocks, you know, cold. But, you know, that's how we think. That's insanity. It was cold, Kevin, you know. I have to talk to him after the meeting. No. Anyway, I came in here in June 1987, and I was broken and I was tired. And I'd also spent 2 weeks in Al-Anon Stone. That was interesting. Al-Anon was interesting. Those women in Al-Anon are so nice. They are so nice, and they know you're stoned. And you're just all like, man, I don't know. My husband sneezed high, you know. Never mind me. I was pregnant to boot. But I thought I was doing really good because I was just having a few beers and some Valium and some marijuana to help me cope with life, you know. Things were bad. And that's the only way I knew how to cope. I was afraid. I was afraid for my life, and I really was. And that's the only way I knew how to cope with life. And I went to those rooms, and they said, well, actually, I had a neighbor. She was 12-stepping me. She'd been in the program a long time, 2 years. That was really long to me. And I said, well, she knew I was an addict, and she knew I was an alcoholic. And she'd been 12-stepping me. She gave me a big book. And I thought, man, I'm going to read this book, and I'm going to fix this guy because he's got this problem, and it is not me. It's never Linda. You know, blame is so good. Blame, rationalization, justification. I mean, those are my all-time favorite. I mean, who doesn't? Who doesn't want to blame somebody else? It's you. Honey, you are so bad. You know, never mind what I'm doing, but you're really bad. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to fix this guy. And I'm reading this big book, right, and it's like, I think they're talking about Linda. I think I'm on these pages here, and I began to relate to what was being said on those pages. I'm going, whoa, wait a minute. I remember those people telling me I might be an alcoholic. And it's like, well, maybe I'm an alcoholic. I have been drinking. I am pregnant, and I don't seem to be able to stop. I think I might be one of these people, you know. And I didn't want to stand up when I first got here because I was ashamed. I was ashamed that I was pregnant and I was drinking. I didn't want anybody to know. But, you know, people know anyways. They know when you're new. I don't know. New radar. I don't know what it is. We know you're new. All the newcomers, we know it. It's true. Man, in fact, Mario, I'm sitting in there and I'm thinking, nobody knows me. I'm sitting in Saturday Night Live. I'm over at Campbell, and Mario's going, well, can you read? And it's like, well, I can, but I can't. You know, I do know how to read, but I really can't. And he thought, no, you got to read here. And who knows? You're new. You don't know the rules. They tell you you got to read. Okay, I'll get up and read. I guess that's the rule. They ask you to read. The rule is read. So I got up there and I read Keys to the Kingdom, you know. It was a trip. They knew I was new. I stood up one time, but they knew I was new. And it was like that night when I was sitting there reading that book and I had had some drinks, and I'm studying the book while I have a few drinks. And I know there's people out there who've done that. You know you did that. So, you know, I'm reading that and I'm going, okay. You know, I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't want to die. And I had been drinking, and we had gotten to a fight, and it was exploding out on the stairs of this apartment. And it was the first time anybody had ever called for help, you know. I'd been beat up a lot of times. I'd been beat up beyond recognition. I had had my eyes, my face, every part of my body had bruises on it. My mother had taken me to the hospital, and she wanted to go in the room with me, and I knew that she couldn't because I knew she couldn't see the rest of my body. She could see my face, but I had my clothes on. It's like, man, I can't take off my clothes in front of my mom. I can't do that. And the doctor's looking at me, and it's like, people are looking because they, oh, I ran into the television. No, it wasn't like that, you know. I did use that for an excuse at the hospital one time. That was when my jaw wouldn't close from being hit, you know. It's like one of those things. I just tripped, ran right in that television. I don't know, got in my way, tripped over the vacuum cleaner cord. I don't know. But that's how I lived, you know. And I knew this night, I knew that if this man had gotten in that apartment that I would die. I knew that beyond a shadow of a doubt that if he beat me up in one of his insane rages that this time I may not make it out alive, you know. And I was scared and I was using. And I'm remembering that as people are telling me, I think you're an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, the police came and got to this man before he got to me in that apartment. And I know that was God working in my life. I'd been drugged upstairs. I'd been knocking on doors. I'd been at doorsteps bloody, my clothes torn off. I had been some places prior to that time. I knew this person. I knew what he had meant to do and purpose to do. And it was that serious for Linda. You know, and the police came and took him to jail, and I cried, and I admitted I was an alcoholic that night. And then I needed to get some help, and I began going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to, you know, work the steps. They say, you know, get a sponsor. I'm in Al-Anon Stone, and they're saying, get a sponsor. And it'd be like, whoa, you don't know how to do that when you're loading in Al-Anon. What do you mean? You know, what are you saying to me? But you got to read the big book there, too, you know. They make you read the same literature. Now they have their own big book, How Al-Anon Works book. Believe me, I read that book. And, you know, so I didn't know about that. But they said, get a sponsor. I'd be like, what does that mean? How do you do that? You have to ask somebody. You have to ask them. I'd be like, what does that mean? Ask somebody. You know, so I'd be like, you have to ask them. Find somebody who's... somebody who's worked the program. I was just like that. I was very neurotic, and I cried a lot, and I was kind of skinny and pregnant all at the same time. It was a weird thing, but it's true. Some people saw me in here knew. And I'm telling you, so I began to find a sponsor. This guy introduced me to a woman. I was a good guy. Hey, you know what? He was like, here, go with this girl here. She didn't even really like me. Then I found out she lived right in the apartment building right next door to me, and it was like, I don't care if she likes me or not. I was too neurotic to know whether I was being rejected or not, you know. It's like, I'm always at her house, I'm knocking at the door going, hey, I'm here, let's, you know, do steps, let's do something, you know. Her mother's dying, she's going, I don't really want this newcomer here, you know. But what happened was is that kind of helped her to go through the death of her mother. Because she had this insane newcomer who didn't know any better of like, hey, let's work steps and do this stuff. And I really know that we got to do that funeral together, you know. And we got to walk through that together in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't have to drink or use over that, you know. It was really pretty cool. And I began to work the steps, and I read the book, and I met with my sponsor, and I went to meetings, and I did everything that they told me to do. You know, when I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable, that was the first step for me. You know, it's like my head and my heart and everything had connected all at the same time. And then when I kind of got after that, it was like, you know what, I'm powerless over people and what they think of me and places and circumstances in my life. And it became to be so much more for Linda through these years than just drugs and alcohol. You know, I'm powerless over a lot of things. But I began to learn that spiritual principle in these rooms. And it began to teach me how to tap into the power where I came and I came to, and I came to believe in the second step that God would restore me, that He would restore me to sanity. He would first restore me to sane thinking, which means He's going to restore Linda's thinking that tells Linda, you know what, you can't take that first drink. It's not going to be different this time. Think, think, think. Think it all the way through. And what I can tell you today is that, you know what, it's been basic AA that has saved my life. It has been the basic spiritual principles behind the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that have kept me clean and sober. And I think anybody who has any time in this program will tell you the same thing. It is the basic principle behind the step. It's so simple, and yet we're so complicated. You know, and then I made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. You know, it wasn't just like, you know, it was my thought life and our financial life and all the lives that are involved in us, my family life, the lives of the people I had affected. You know, I had to learn how to turn it over. I had to learn how to give them up to God. Now, I'm not coming in here to find God, but the big book says that the purpose of the book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. I mean, that can solve all your problems. It does restore you, too. So you know what? I began to learn how to do that. I began to learn how to pray, and I began to learn how to be in a relationship with God. And you know, after I made that decision, it's like I'm sitting at my sponsor's house, and she's saying, you got to work the steps, and you got to do this writing. But it's like, you know, I wanted to get the result, but I didn't really want to have to write. And I don't know who wants to write, but it was like, you know, that was one of the most valuable things that she's ever said to me. I mean, all these years in sobriety, it's been like, you want the result, Linda, but you're not willing to do the work. That's the bottom line. You want the result, you got to do the work. Got to do the writing. You got to do it the way the book says to do it. I didn't get sponsored like their idea of what the program is. I got sponsored by somebody who was real responsible by going by the book. This wasn't her program. It was the program. What does the book say? Always bringing me back to the book. Always bringing me back to God. Always bringing me back to, where's God in all this? Where's your trust in God? You know, how are you giving this up to God? Is God going to do this for you or he's not going to do it? I mean, what is the deal here, right? And so I began to do that. And I wrote my fourth step. And, you know, this year, I want to talk about this year because this was a really strange year for me where I came down to all these years I've been grooving in my sobriety. I've had an absolute great sobriety, right? And then this year, it's like, man, I had the hardest year I'd had for many, many years. And there had been situations in my life that I hadn't gone through clean and sober. You know, and I'd heard people talking from up at the podium about, you know what, I had this much time and I felt like drinking or using, or they actually did and they go out 9, 10 years. I don't know. You know, that could have been me. Every cell in my body saying, you know what, I want to change the way I feel. I'm in crisis and I'm going, man, you know what I had to do? I had to do the work. I had to dig deep for that connection, that get that connection going on. And it was like, man, I'm in the fifth chapter of How It Works. And I'm telling you, it was like God just going, oh, total revelation, a total new pair of glasses, totally new way to view the steps. It was as if I had never read them before because I was in so much pain. It was like, you know what, I don't really want to drink or use, but I don't want to stay feeling like I'm feeling. I want to be out of the pain. And I'd had a generally, you know what, I'd done my work. I'd been to counseling. I'd been to Kids Are Special. We're a core family member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd done all this stuff, but it was like, man, I need to have something more because I was going through some heavy stuff. And so I began to use that along with the fourth step and the 12x12. And I'm telling you, he gave me this thing on fear. And I really want to talk about this because it was so deep. If you can get this piece about fear, you know, you really have a real solid thing going on for your sobriety. This was the thing. It was like, you know how it talks about in chapter 5, resentment is the number one offender, and from it stems all forms of spiritual disease. You know, and when the spiritual straightens out, so does the physical and the emotional. So we better have some connection going on. We better get some God stuff going on. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I had God people in my life and people who taught me how to pray and people who were praying for me when I couldn't pray for myself, you know. When I couldn't do that for myself, they were there praying for me on my behalf, you know. It was kind of weird in the beginning to first start praying with somebody, you know. But I've been doing that for a while now. And it's like, man, it's the most natural thing to me today. And if I'm not praying, it's like I'm missing something. And I thank God that I learned how to have a relationship with Him. I didn't come in here to find out about God. I came in here to get clean and sober. And I don't even know if that's all true. I came in here so my kids didn't have to go through the insanity that I was living. Because I didn't know I had any value and I didn't know I had any worth when I came in here. And I knew that my unborn child and my 5-year-old daughter deserved something better than what Linda was giving them. And they were worth something. And what I learned here is that, you know what, I learned how to receive love and to receive the good that God was placing in my life. I never had good. I didn't even know how to do good. I knew how to do miserable. And so good was like totally, yeah, boy, you've done miserable. That's why we're all here. We were in some misery. I don't know. We came in here because we were doing so well, and I thought I would just check out an AA meeting. We don't do that, not. I don't know. Thought he would just support him. Okay. All right. Okay, well, I want you to get this piece that I got. I want to pass it on because this spiritual truth that I got in this time of my life, in this last year, was just totally deep. And I began to go through the four-step and the 12x12, and I began to see every place that it said about fear or being afraid. I mean, highlight in the big book every time it talks about we were afraid or we were scared or the word fear. I mean, go through and highlight the dang book. I mean, it is filled with fear, fear, fear. Okay, it says go to the next page. We're saying bracketed alongside each resentment is what? Fear. The word fear. So is it resentment the number one offender, or is it the fear behind the resentment that's driving you into that thing that's the offender? I don't know. I got the fear thing. That's what I got today out of that book. Because I just dug deep enough to read between that line. You know, it was like getting everything I could get. And I began to really highlight and to check out those places. But I didn't only check out the bad places. I checked out the promise. You know, a new freedom. A new arch to freedom, and I need to get set free. I was hurting, and I needed to get free. I needed to have that emotional sobriety restored, you know. And so I began to say, well, what the heck is the fear? It says put the fear on paper. Put the resentment on the paper. Put the fear on the paper. Put your sex inventory on the paper. It was like, okay, got the paper thing. I mean, I had some paper and I'm writing, right? I'm writing the resentment, but it wasn't enough to just say, well, I was having a little fear about that. What was Linda really afraid of? I mean, what was driving? I was afraid, you know, they didn't like me. I'm afraid of being rejected. I'm afraid of people are talking about me. I'm afraid of losing what I have, of not getting what I want. I'm just in fear. I mean, I am in some fear here. You know, it isn't going my way. It isn't going to happen in the right time. They're not doing it the way I think they should. It's just not going to happen because, what, is Linda on the throne or is God on the throne? You know, I create a mess. You know, it's like, ugh, confusion. That's right. Kevin knows. He lives with me. He saw it all. He was there. Eyewitness. But, you know, I began to go back and I began to look at the fears, and like behind every resentment would be like 5 and 10 fears. I mean, list 10 resentments that you got going on. You got 100 fears driving those resentments, man. I was like, I had to get down to that. And it was like, you know what they had? They had the solution. They didn't just say, here, put it on the paper, but here's the solution of after we get it on the paper. What's the solution? You know, we ask God to remove our fear. And at once we begin to outgrow the fear. It didn't say, oh, well, you're not going to be afraid anymore. It means I'm outgrowing it. It means I continue to give it up to Him. It means I'm outgrowing that fear, and that fear isn't running me anymore. But I have it on the paper, and I've shared it with God and another human being. And that fear doesn't have me anymore. I get to look at it, and it doesn't get to run me. You know, and that's what happens. We begin to run on fear, and we make decisions in our fear, and it's just like fear, fear, fear. It was heavy. It was deep. It says, you know what it says in there? It says, we consider its common manifestations. We're taking the stock in trade. We're considering the common manifestations. You know where you're going to find them? You're going to find them in the book, and it lists them all throughout the fourth step about the 7 deadly sins. It talks about pride and ego and jealousies and envies and resentments. I mean, it's going, these are the common manifestations. It wasn't even anything new. Who in this room has not gone through these common manifestations? It says we better be considering the common manifestation. It isn't even anything new or conjured up or some secret thing. They're common things that plague us. They're the enemies of our soul. And so I began to consider the common manifestation. And I began to put those on paper. And you know what? I got to see behind the common manifestation was fear. If I'm in jealousy, what am I afraid of? Oh, they like that person better than they like me. Or they're going to go be with them and they're not going to be with me. I mean, it's all fear-based, is it not? I'm angry. I'm in fear behind the anger. You know, it's like envy. Oh, I'm afraid they have more than me. You know, all of this stuff you can, it was like I had a whole graph. I'm serious too. I put these things on paper and I had a graph, you know. And the at the top of the graph was control. You know what it talks about? It has control listed in there. It does. It talks about control. We want them to behave. If all the players would stay put, everything would go well. We'd all rest satisfaction if you'd all do it my way and what I want you to do. Isn't that, aren't you? I mean, we are control freaks. I am a control freak. I had to like read Compelled to Control book. You know, it's like, hey, you know, get a grip on these things. If you'd all been doing this my way, you'd all be so happy, and I'd be happy too, and we'd all be happy. And it says, you know what? People retaliate against that stuff. They don't like you doing that stuff with them, you know? So it's like, oh, okay, God help me not to do this stuff. I mean, it's like, all right, you try and you let go and you let God, all right? And he say, no, let me help you, because it's not happening fast enough. So we begin to be the God helper, like he really needs your help, right? You know, we all help a little now and then. Right. I want to help you out, God, because I think I know better than you. I think if you just try it my way over here a little bit, then you know what? God, you'd be happy too. I don't know. You know, we do. You know you do that. All would be well. And they retaliate. We're going, we can't figure out, what's going on? What's going on with you guys? Why are you all, you know, freaking out over there? Ah, you know, hey. But you know what's behind control is fear. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Why are you controlling? So you're in fear. You're afraid you're not going to get what you want. You're afraid that it's not going to happen the way you think it should happen. And so we go out and we control everybody because, you know what, God didn't make any junk. He's on the throne. He never got off the throne. And he's going to do it. He doesn't need our help. You know, and do we trust him? You know, do you trust him? I was like, Linda, trust me. I'd be on my knees. He'd be saying, Linda, trust me. Trust me. I'm going to work it out. Just let it go. And I'd be like, oh, letting go with fingernail marks in it, you know. Just trust me. I mean, that was a big word. Trust God that he is able, that the arm of the Lord is not too short to reach down into your circumstance and cause it to end up exactly the way he wants it to. And it's like, Linda, are you willing to yield yourself to him? Are you willing to say, okay, God, any way you want to do this thing? You know, and there's so much freedom in that. It's a hard thing to do, is to give up your plan and design and say, okay, God, you know what? Have your way. Let's do it God's way. You know, whatever you want to do here, God. Because, man, I was afraid. I was afraid of losing what I had. I was afraid of losing this friendship. I was afraid, you know, of tomorrow. Because I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. I can't control it because I'm not there yet. You know, it's like, hey, we only have today to control. And, right, we're not there yet tomorrow, but we do think of plans and ways to do it for tomorrow, don't we? We lay there at bed night, nee, 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 nee. I know a plan. I got a plan. I know what I'll do. I'll call them up and I'll tell them this. And then I'll call these people up over here and I'll tell them that. And then everybody will be happy, right? That's right. Yeah, it's true. That's right. That's control. That's manipulation. Justification, rationalization. They're all friends with each other. They all know each other. They have a plan against us. They say, well, this is what we're going to do with her today. We're going to plan this thing. We're going to come in full force, and we're going to attack, right? And it's like, ah! You know, here I am. It's like, yep. You know they do. They just leap on you, and you're going, oh, God, help me. You know, it's like, I do that, too. I know when they're coming. I say, oh, I know your plan. They do. They come on you and they're attacking you. And you know what? It just comes back to, Linda, do you trust me? Do you trust God? You know, so here I am. I'm writing this thing down and it's like, you know what? I had to get my resentments on the paper because, you know what? If I'm all resentful and I'm angry and all that, I'm not hearing real good from God. It's blocking me off from my connection, you know. I'm spiritually drowning by this haze of resentment and unforgiveness. Now, for Linda today, it's like, you know what? I just choose to forgive. I just choose to forgive. Now, I may not have no big way out feeling of forgiveness. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't feel like, ooh, gee, I've really forgiven you, and I love you so much, and let's go have some lunch. I don't do that. I'd say, no, I've chosen to forgive that because I know God wants me to. And you know what? When I blow it, I want you to forgive me. And it's like I want to extend that principle of forgiveness. It's not enough for me to just put it on the paper and say, I have the resentment, I have the fear, and share it with God and another human being without actually going on through with the sixth and the seventh step of, you know what, I'm humbly asking you. I am entirely ready to give all that I know how to give to you, God. I am humbly asking you to take this from me. I'm laying it down before you and this other person, my sponsor, and I'm saying, God, change Linda. Take this stuff from me when I don't know how to do it for myself. I don't know how to do that for myself. All I know is that when I'm willing to ask Him, the grace of God enters, and you know what? He does it. It blows my mind, but He does it over and over and over again. And the thing is the fear lies to me and says, He's not going to do it this time. But you know what the fact is? I have tons. I have years and years and years of experience that says He'll do it again. He'll do it again. He'll change you. He'll take that fear. Somebody's being paged. Is that Carlos? No, just teasing. Just teasing you, Carlos. I know you don't have a pager. Okay. You know, it is him. He does, after all. Look. Carlos, you have to forgive, remember. He's making a choice. All right. That's right. Well, I'm telling you. So you know what? So I have the resentments and I have the fear and I have everything on my paper. I've shared with my sponsor. I'm sharing with God. But you know what I do next is I begin to pray. Because when I'm humbly asking Him, you know what? Or I am entirely ready. I'm as ready as I know how to be. I don't know who's entirely ready. I'm not quite sure what entirely means. But I know for me, entirely means I am willing to give you all that I know how to give at the moment in time with what I have. And so I lay that out there and I say, God, I am entirely ready for you to change me. Change my attitude. You know, Kevin here had a big spiritual experience. The room went bright and everything. And the rest of us, I don't know. But I didn't have that. And the big book talks about what a spiritual experience means. And Bill Wilson had that same where the room illuminated and all that stuff and God came. It was like really cool and everything. You know, it's like me, I get to have a change of attitude like the back of the book says. That's a spiritual experience for Linda is that we simply had a change of attitude. You know, I have a different perception. I get to have a God perception on that situation, you know. And it isn't even about the situation, you know. It's about our focus. I mean, where are we focusing our stuff? I have to keep my eyes focused on God. I got to keep that relationship going on so I don't get caught up with my little details. I'm very detail-orientated, and then that makes me want to control. You know, I have to take control. We have too many details that need attending here, and I'll help God again. I don't know. You know, it's like, God, can I help you out today? You know, so that's one thing I have to continually give up. I have to die to myself, you know, so that I can have more of Him and less of Linda. More God, less Linda. God, I want to know you more. I want to be in relationship with you more. You know, I'm on my knees and I pray to God. And you know, the presence of God comes because I ask Him to come. And when it's hard, I say, you know what, do for me, God, what I can't do for myself. And when they talk about those hard times and they talk about that footprint and God is carrying you on through, like I've had those times. I know it's true. I know God's real. I know He's so real. And if you're new here today and you don't understand what we're talking about, is that, you know what, we're talking about a solution to alcoholism. And you got to get a book. And you got to get a sponsor. And you got to do the work. And through getting the book and the sponsor and beginning to do the work, you know what? We began to see some relationship with God, and people are talking about how they've had their experience with God. And you know what? We get to recover, and the healing begins to come, and you begin to learn how to receive the good things that God's placing in your life. And everybody in here is all talking about the God thing, and some of you can and some of you can't. If you can't right now, that's okay. But don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't quit before you get to know Him, before you come and come to and come to believe. I believe with all my heart that God will restore me. He'll restore any circumstance in my life. He may not restore it in the way Linda thinks it should be restored, though. He's going to restore it exactly the way it's supposed to be, though. Acceptance is the key to all my problems today, because when I am disturbed, it's because I find some person, some place, something, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I cannot have any peace until I accept that person, place, or thing for being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment in time, because God is on the throne. He is everything or He's nothing. It says that in the book. Sounds to me like we do have a decision to make. Now, is it made because you had a big feeling about it? No, it's because you're making a choice. I'm making a decision. And it isn't based on how my emotions are going in and out of this thing. It's based on, you know what? I'm believing, I'm trusting those who have gone before me, who say God's real, who's worked the steps, who have a sponsor, who've managed to stay clean and sober. It's worked for them, and I'm believing that if it worked for them, they can work for me too. I believe that. I believe that today. I believe that God can carry me through any circumstance in my life today if I let Him. If I will allow Him to work through me. If I'll do the work. If I'll do the writing. Even at 9 years clean and sober, I got to do the work. If I'm tangled up in the day, I got to do the work and I have to do the reading. You know, I got to go back to that 10th step. I have to read that 11th step. Make me the channel of your peace. You know, it's like, hey, that's not always easy. I'm caught up in my stuff. I'm hurting. I'm broken, you know. And I'm trying to walk this thing out one day at a time. And the greatest success is I didn't have to drink over that today. I made it one day at a time, and I didn't get it perfect. I was walking wounded. You know what? It isn't like, oh, you can't go through things. If you're afraid, you can't have faith. And that's just crap. You know what? I did a lot of things afraid, and I had the faith to believe that God was going to make the result work out. He was going to do it. And I had experience I could get grateful for every time He had done it in my life to recall those times. And I carried the message. I kept showing up in the 12th step. I was working with others, and I kept showing up. I didn't want to show up. I didn't want to be there. I had to stand up before women and share experience, strength, and hope, or give a talk, or be out at the jail and be helping them. And it's like, man, I'm dying on the inside. You know, but I'm showing up anyways. I don't feel like it, but you know what? I had enough training on me that I got to learn how to go even when I don't want to go. You know, I don't always feel like showing up, but I go even when I don't want to go because I've had that training early on. And you know, I'm so grateful for my first sponsor. And you know, you couldn't even call that woman if you didn't have your writing. It wasn't like, hey, you get to call. I wanted to cry. I wanted to whine, snivel a little. You know, I wanted to do that. We like that. We do. And it was like, nobody grinds or snivels or has self-pity in here, I know. It's just me because I'm unique. I have unique sobriety. Not. Okay. So you know what? It's like this. It's like, you know what? She'd make me write. Say, you got any writing? I'd be all, well, I just want to, no. Go write about it, then you call me back. And you know what I learned how to do is every day I'd get up in the morning. And I had maybe, this is my first 1 in 2 years, and I would write for a straight year every day. I'd just write down. It was like, man, you wake up and you're plagued with that fear. Oh, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of the kids. I'm afraid I might have a bad day. I mean, I don't even know if I'm going to have a bad day or not, but I might. You know, it's like I could have a bad day. I might not have any food, and it's like I always had food, but I'd still be afraid I wouldn't have enough. And it'd be like, you know, that's how I am. And so I would get to see how I'm run on fear from the very beginning. I would get to write these things down. I would get to call my sponsor, and she would always bring me back to, where is God? Linda, where's God? I don't know where God is. I'm trying to get a relationship. I don't know. You know, you're trying to get this connection going on. And I wasn't really good at God stuff because I wasn't proficient at it. I hadn't had much practice out there being loaded, doing the God thing, you know. You know, it's like I'm trying to have this relationship going on, you know. And so she gave me a good foundation, and she taught me how to write, and she taught me how to have discipline. We're not disciplined people. You know what? We just do what we want to do. We don't have boundaries. I didn't know about boundaries. You know, so I began to learn how to do these things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for you too, honey, for my husband. I met my husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my first sober Christmas, and Kevin just walked in my house. You could have an open house from Alcoholics Anonymous and get a husband too. I don't know. I mean, it's like we played Pictionary, and that was it. That's 9 years ago in December. It was my first sober Christmas, and I've been with him ever since. He 13-stepped me. He knows it. You did. It's true. But it worked. Doesn't work for everybody. Just work for us. We don't recommend it to newcomers. No, we don't. We recommend you stay out of a relationship. Well, you know, one thing that we do have is that we've learned to have a long-term relationship. Me and Kevin have been together 9 years this December, and that doesn't happen in these rooms all the time. You know, we've had a sober relationship. We've raised 5 children together. We have, he's never called me names. He doesn't yell at me. He doesn't curse me out and tell me you're so stupid. You know what happens when you do that is that you open up a place. It's like, you know what, there's no point of return there once you start cursing each other out. And so we just knew we came from that. He'd been stabbed a couple times all by the same woman. It was like, it's true. And so, I mean, he'd been thrown the other end with this insane woman, and I had this insane man. But in Alcoholics Anonymous and through God, we have the same spiritual beliefs. We can pray together. We can minister together. You know, we sing together. We do a lot of things together, you know. And so we're able to maintain a solid relationship. I wouldn't have that if I was loaded today. I wouldn't have anything that I have today. My children are healthy. They make good grades. We're able to be a parents today and present, and, you know, I'm grateful for that. And I know that it was the women in this program who took me to coffee and spent time with me and talked me through things. And, you know, I did want that sympathy, and it was like, there's Marty M., and all she'd do is read the book at me. I was like, I want to talk. I want to cry a little bit. And she's just reading the book at me. I'm no sympathy whatsoever. I was like, I learned the book. And I said, I did. That's how I learned the book. She read to me. It would be like, nope, we're going by the book here. Okay, it's like hardcore AA time, you know. I'd go on 12-step calls. They'd call me up, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to 12-step. I had a couple months of sobriety, and they'd say, go pick up this woman and bring her to a meeting. I mean, she's like 17, just snots running out her nose. It's like, okay, come to a meeting, honey. I don't know. It's like, just come with me. But, you know, I couldn't be loaded if I was helping her stay sober. They'd call me up, and I'd call up my buddy Ramona, and I'd say, Ramona, come on, we're going on a 12-step call. It's like 11 o'clock, and they're saying, bring her to the midnight meeting. I'm reading How It Works and Into Action and Working with Others, you know, so I could get this How to Work with Others thing, you know, so I could do it by the book. And that's how I learned. That's how I learned. I learned by experience. I learned by what does the book say? Oh, we just share in a general way our experience, our strength, and our hope. Okay, I just get to talk about me. I don't have to say, dang, you're more messed up than I am. You shouldn't be drinking, you know. I get to go by the book, you know. You catch him at that low moment where he's kind of humble. Say, we have some help here for you if you want it, if you want what we have. Well, that's how I learned. I learned everything by experience, and because I'm an action-type person, I had to have a lot of action out there, and I had to have some good action in here. And I'm telling you, there's never a dull moment working with others. There's never a dull moment working with another alcoholic. And it has been the most rewarding thing and kept me sober. But you know what? I always worked with women. I always have. I always worked with others. And I always have been able to share my beliefs in God. I've always been able to teach them how to pray and help them get that connection. You know, Linda, what are you doing? And, you know, that's been a blessing to me. We've had many, many parties in our house, sober parties, and just to really celebrate sobriety. You know, all the potlucks, all the conventions, all of the things, the dancing, the fellowship in the rooms, you know, and we get to learn how to grow spiritually in this. Everything in those steps is a spiritual principle. And God's principles work. They just work. Whether you believe God or not, His principle is going to work. It works if you work it. You know, and I just want to end on that note. It works if you work it. It's all the basic things of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all about getting that relationship with God going on. It's all about doing the work. And that's how we get to stay here, working with others, showing up, even when we don't want to. So I want to thank you for letting me share.